From NPR News, this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Paul Rayburn. When you hear the phrase same-sex couple, the first thing that pops into your mind is probably not an albatross or a worm or a fruit fly. But as it happens, those animals and other members of the animal kingdom do engage in same-sex sexual behaviors. This can include grooming or preening and even coupling. According to a review of research published this week in the journal Trends in Ecology and Evolution, most groups of animals take part in some sort of same-sex behavior. Joining me now to explore what these relationships can tell us about animal evolution is my guest, Nathan Bailey, a postdoctoral researcher at the University of California, Riverside. He joins us by phone. Thanks for talking with us, Dr. Bailey.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
So it's a surprise to me that there is this kind of behavior widespread in the animal kingdom. Was it a surprise to you, or is this something that zoologists and others have known about for a long time?
Well, zoologists have known about this for quite a long time. And in fact, about 10 years ago, a large book was published by Bruce Bagamell called Biological Exuberance, in which he enumerated over 450 species of animals that do engage in some sort of same-sex behavior. What has become surprising to me over the course of the last 10 years is just the sheer number of examples that are continuing to come in the peer-reviewed literature about this and the variety of forms that these behaviors can take.
Now, what you did was not do a new study, but look at all the existing literature as much as you could find and try to sum it up. Is that right?
That's right. What my co-author Marlene Zook and I realized was that there wasn't any large synthesis of this sort of work that's been published in a peer-reviewed journal. And so we were interested in looking at commonalities across species and differences across species and kind of providing a scientific framework to think about same-sex behavior in an evolutionary context.
Now, is that what your research involves, or were you doing something different and took a bit of a diversion here?
Well, actually, it's a bit of a diversion. My ordinary research does focus on the evolution of reproductive behavior, and I study this in field crickets. So both Marlene and I were interested in flexibility in mating behavior, and so kind of a natural extension of that was same-sex sexual behavior.
Now, I have to mention to listeners that if you want to take a look at Nathan Bailey's website on the web, you'll see him with a field cricket in his mouth. Is that what that is?
Actually, that's a large species of katydid. It's called a Mormon cricket. I studied them for my PhD, and they can be eaten, although that one managed to escape whole.
Now, give us a few examples of the same-sex behavior in some animals. What do they do? What does it consist of?
Well, as you mentioned in your introduction, it can consist of a variety of things. So we kind of loosely defined it as any behavior that members or animals of the same sex engage in that animals of opposite sexes also engage in the context of reproduction. So that could be anything from courtship to preening to rearing young together to actual copulation. And so in some insects, such as the fruit fly, Drosophila melanogaster, this can take the form of males courting other males by singing to them or actually mounting other males. And this contrasts with other species, such as Laison albatross, in which females form long-term pair bonds together, and they actually build a nest together. They'll incubate an egg together and rear the chick. So there's a wide variety of different manifestations of the behavior.
Now, I would think that in these cases, the aim of these kinds of partnerships is often for reproduction, particularly in animals where they don't send flowers and chick quote poetry. What is going on? Why are the animals doing this if in many cases it's not going to lead to reproduction?
That's a great question, and it does come up a lot, so it's good to clarify. And what we like to point out is that sex isn't always about sex. So even in opposite sex interactions, sexual or behaviors that look sexual on the surface can have other functions. They could function in pair bonding, or they could be involved in dominance or aggressive interactions. So the first thing to keep in mind is that it's not always about sex. And the second thing to keep in mind is that animals do a variety of behaviors, from aggression to altruistic behaviors, where there's no apparent benefit to the actor, where it's not entirely clear how it leads directly to reproduction. So we view same-sex sexual behavior in kind of this same framework as as a behavior that may be sexual but is not necessarily all about sex.
Let me ask a loaded question. It may be impossible to answer. is this behavior aberrant behavior of some sort, or can we not address that kind of question?
Well, no, I think it's important to discuss that question. And when we looked at the literature in the field, we found many, many, many examples of these sorts of behaviors. So from that point of view, it's not aberrant. The question about what its ultimate function is, its evolutionary function, is still a very open question, and there are lots of hypotheses out there about that. And so some people can consider it to be adaptive in some circumstances, but there's evidence that it's not adaptive in other circumstances, and that it may just be a byproduct of, say, selection on another trait.
So, and that would vary from one species to another, depending on the particulars of why they're engaging in this behavior and exactly what the behavior is.
Precisely. And in addition to that, it could vary between different contexts, even within the same species. So it just kind of increases the variety of behaviors that can be observed.
What happens in fruit flies? That seems to be a far removed example. What do they do in terms of same-sex behavior?
So fruit flies do engage in same-sex behavior in a kind of a wild setting where males will court or attempt to copulate with other males. But the vast majority of research in fruit flies has been done in the lab. And these experiments are manipulative experiments where, for example, researchers may knock out a particular gene that's involved in the recognition of sex-specific peptides or sex-specific pheromones. So if you remove that sort of gene or you alter it in a male fruit fly, that male fruit fly may subsequently court or mount other males as well as females. And in essence, it's because they can't really tell, you know, to whom they are directing their courtship advances.
Right. So do you conclude, to get back to the evolutionary question again, the evolutionary advantage and so forth, do we assume that some of these animals engaging in same-sex behavior are suffering an evolutionary disadvantage as a result of that?
I think that would be very difficult to tell. And again, you would have to have kind of an explicit framework of hypothesis testing. Scientists can test different hypotheses that would explain the existence of same-sex behavior in animals. For example, same-sex behavior might mediate dominance interactions, or it might provide practice for later opposite-sex sexual encounters. Or it may not have any apparent function, or it may be a byproduct of selection on other traits. And so by explicitly testing that, you can begin to get at some of those questions.
Now, I've been saving up a question for you here, and I want to make sure we have time to address it.
Okay.
An obvious thing that I'm sure has occurred to many listeners and certainly occurred to me when I read it is, What are the implications in this for human same-sex behavior?
So the implications for human same-sex behavior. Well, so first of all, our review, we attempted to distill all of the work that we were reading into the very kind of scientific essence of the data. We wanted to strip it of all of the kind of political and emotional baggage just so that we could be as accurate and neutral in tone as possible. But we recognize that for many people, this issue is more than just academic. And when it comes to politics, I would, you know, leave the decisions to the politicians. What we wanted to do was provide a basic, you know, foundation for thinking about the issue scientifically.
And did you look at research on humans as part of this, or only non-humans?
We actually did, yeah. We have a section in the paper on just a sampling of the studies that have been done on human beings. And in fact, there are loads of studies on human beings. And one of the conclusions that we came to is that research on other animals could benefit from using some of the same techniques that have been used on research in humans.
What's an example?
So an example of that is genome-wide scans have looked at the genetic architecture of sexual orientation in human beings with varying degrees of success.
So this is a way to sort of check all the genes that a person has and see whether there are differences associated with same-sex behavior, in a sense.
Right, exactly. So it's kind of correlating, you know, a particular chromosomal location with the existence of the behavior. And to our knowledge, we certainly didn't find any evidence in the animal literature that people are using a similar approach. Now, with the exception of Drosophila research, which has looked extensively at genetic pathways involved in same-sex sexual behavior.
Drosophila, that's fruit flies.
Yes, sorry, that's right.
Mm-hmm. Right, go ahead.
But what would be really interesting to look at in other animals is the extent to which the environment versus the genetic background of the animal contributes to same-sex sexual behavior. And as of now, we really don't have any idea about that.
Let me take caller Keith in Alaska. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Go ahead.
My question is a little bit counterintuitive to what your last statement was, where you tried to take out the ramifications of social behavior and society and the political aspect. I think it's almost beneficial to those who may not understand in some cases where, you know, what people would call sexual deviancies to be actually natural. I look at it from a perspective, if you have male on one hand and you have female on the other hand, and then in the middle you actually have hermaphrodites, and which are totally real, you know, that they happen and is a natural phenomena of this world, then that you could have anything leading up to a hermaphrodite and leading away from a hermaphrodite on the male or female scale, and that those chemical, you have a physical manifestation of, you know, having the genitalia of both, or you might have male genitalia, but your hormonal scenario would be where you have a higher.
Okay, Keith. Thanks for the call. Yeah, thanks for the call. Dr. Cairns, has this research posed any interesting questions that you can now pursue? New questions you might want to pursue?
One of the interesting questions that we would like to pursue, and I haven't quite mentioned in the interview yet, is that people tend to think of same-sex behaviors or same-sex sexual behaviors as traits that may or may not be shaped by evolutionary processes. But what I would like to accomplish is to shift the perspective a bit and start considering these traits as evolutionary forces in and of themselves. So, for example, if you have a population of animals with a certain frequency of same-sex behavior in it, that same-sex behavior is going to change the social context that all of the animals in the population experience. And this will have kind of knock-on effects on evolutionary pressures on other traits, other social traits, or maybe even morphological or like anatomical traits.
And these are things you can study.
They're going to be difficult to study, but I think that they can be studied. And, you know, some of the first steps will be getting estimates for the genetic component of the behaviors versus, you know, components of the behaviors that can be induced by environmental factors.
Let me say that I'm Paul Rayburn. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Thank you very much.
I'd like to thank you so much for being with us. My guest has been Nathan Bailey, a postdoctoral researcher at the University of California, Riverside. I guess we can call you Dr. Bailey in that case.
That's
he
fine.
Joins us by phone. Thanks so much for talking with us, Dr. Bailey.
No problem. It's been my pleasure.